Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is a speech by Shama Sawant given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington on February 22, 2025. The theme was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. Shama Sawant is an Indian-American politician and economist who served on the Seattle City Council from 2014 to 2024. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. And now, Shama Sawant.
The billionaires and their system are in crisis. Political parties around the world, parties that represent the elite, are facing revolt after revolt from working people. Last year in the elections of all 10 leading industrialized nations, the incumbents were either booted out or lost a big share of the vote. This was the first time this has ever happened in almost 120 years of records. Here in the US, the approval rating of the former incumbent Democratic Party is currently in the rubbish heap. Nearly half of registered Democratic Party voters disapprove of them. And overall, only 21% approve of how Democrats in Congress are handling themselves in the present crisis. The revolt of working people against the establishment is fundamentally about the bankruptcy of capitalism and its representatives. The cost of living crisis, the skyrocketing rents, the undermining of the public services working people rely on, the death of the American dream. Working people are fed up with going broke just to buy groceries or pay their rent. Meanwhile, wealth continues to be rapidly amassed at the top. Amidst our desperate struggle for survival, last year saw the world's five richest billionaires increase their wealth by $542 billion. Elon Musk, Trump's current favorite billionaire, has $500 billion in wealth. This revolt against the Democratic Party does not mean working people are giving Trump permission to run roughshod over them either. It is true that a section of the working class has illusions that Trump is their guy, and this raises a crucial strategy question for us. How do we win those working people over to a fight back? Because we have seen that on issue after issue, whether it is raising the minimum wage or taxing the rich or Medicare for all or ending the genocide in Gaza, American working people are more progressive than ever before. Some of the states that voted for Trump last year also passed ballot initiatives for a $15 minimum wage, paid sick leave, union support, and abortion rights. And a recent poll confirms that there is not majority support for the bulk of Trump's anti-worker agenda and the pet projects of the Republican Party. A majority opposed Trump's brutal attacks on federal employees. A majority of Americans are vehemently opposed to Trump's plan to permanently extend his 2017 tax cuts for the rich, tax cuts that Biden continued. Large majorities oppose eliminating the repayment plan that helps student loan borrowers and funding cuts for federal student loans and grants. Over 80% oppose cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, commonly known as food stamps. And a whopping 90% of Americans are against cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Trump's own approval ratings, while higher in the past, are basically breaking even. About an equal number approve and disapprove. And this is during his so-called honeymoon period. These approval ratings have nowhere to go but down. But we should not expect that it will happen overnight. We should not be complacent. And in the meantime, Trump and the billionaires are going for broke. They want to do maximum damage at this moment before a serious opposition to their assault develops and before the real impacts of the damage they're doing becomes clear. The main success of this billionaire in the White House has been tapping into the widespread anger at the establishment. And in this, he's been handed a humongous gift by the rotten Democratic Party and its endless betrayals of working people, which allowed him to get reelected after he left office as the most unpopular president in modern American history. The huge irony is that Trump is the one capitalizing on working class anger, the anger that is actually at billionaires and the rich, and the very same class that Trump himself belongs to and represents. Politicians and the corporate media were stunned by the show of support on social media for Luigi Mangione, the man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson last year. They were even more shocked when polling showed that this was not some fringe phenomenon, but a strong majority sentiment, nearly 70%. This anger represents a historic opening to fight for fundamental change if it can be redirected into a working class movement. Killing individual CEOs is no solution. Thompson has already been replaced with another blood-sucking executive. And if such killings were to continue, they would be used as a pretext to attack workers and increase the powers of the police. Instead, we need to build powerful mass movements of the millions against the billionaires. It's only through working class power that we can win a different kind of society. Our goal must be to both fight for radical change in the present and to bring down the billionaires and their system, capitalism. Unfortunately, alongside the fury of working people, the most prominent feature of this political moment is the near total vacuum of clear leadership on the left and in the labor movement. There is a profound shortage of leaders prepared to break with the political parties of the rich. We've seen betrayals one after another of these so-called progressives, Bernie Sanders, AOC and the Squad, and progressive labor leaders like Sean Fain. Both Bernie and AOC played a central role in bringing Trump to power. They uncritically supported Biden and then rushed to endorse Harris. They abandoned Medicare for All. They abandoned the fight for a $15 minimum wage. They could have organized mass rallies on either of those demands and put massive pressure on both parties and built a new party in the process. Instead, they put a premium on their peaceful relations with the elite, squandered a historic opportunity, and carried out a historic betrayal. There is a meme going around of Bernie Sanders' action figure that has a stamp on it saying sold out. I'm not sure if there's one for AOC. In any case, that meme is the epitaph of the Bernie movement. Sadly, it was a predictable ending. I, like many of you, was part of Sanders' movement, and we were correct to be because millions were coming together, but some of us did so with our eyes open. From the beginning, myself and the socialists who are part of revolutionary workers today noted the fundamental mistake of funneling people into the Democratic Party. We warned about the dead-end nature of this strategy of a political revolution against the billionaire class from inside a party that is owned lock, stock, and barrel by that same billionaire class. The most recent stunt by Bernie Sanders, this so-called tour against the oligarchs, is also telling. Even at this moment, Sanders is trying to redirect people back towards the Democratic Party. One of his three central planks is reform the party. Reform the party? Seriously? This party that has stabbed us all in the back 1,000 times over? I don't think so. job is to burn the Democratic Party to the ground. To destroy any remaining illusions in it, in any idea that it represents workers or oppressed people. We need a new mass party for the working class and the oppressed. The organizations here, like Workers' Strike Back, the Green Party, and all of us, we have an important role to play in that process. But that will not happen so long as lesser evilism rules the day, and until the utterly failed strategy of voting for one billionaire party so that another billionaire party can win is abandoned. We need to build an organized, unified movement of working people to systematically take on the rich who run society and undermine their ability to rule. We have a lot of wind at our backs. There is a major opening for working class politics. But we also have real obstacles. We face the absolute disaster that the left and labor leadership have become. And along with that, all the rotten ideas that are being argued for by those misleaders. So we need to return to the basics, and we need to get something straight. First, this system does not belong to us. Capitalism is a system of rule by the rich and solely for the rich. It is based on stealing the wealth you and I create through our labor, as Karl Marx explained 175 years ago. Or, as the late George Carlin said somewhat more recently, it's a big club and you ain't in it. Second, the main reason this tiny sliver of society, the billionaires, the capitalist class, are able to own more wealth than a large majority of the world's population, more than billions, the only reason they can make us work long hours and live off crumbs while they amass untold wealth is by dividing working people, the overwhelming majority of society. To overcome that, we need to be clear about some things. By far, the most important division in society is between the capitalists and the rest of us. Between them, the rich, and the immense majority of us who struggle to survive. To succeed, we need to be clear about who our friends are and who our enemies are. Our enemies are the billionaires and the bosses, the capitalist class, their institutions, their political parties, and also their more treacherous spokespeople who sometimes appear and sound like they support workers, but really act as pressure release valves and gatekeepers. Our enemies are not other working class or middle class or poor people. They are not immigrants or tech workers or workers in the South. Or Muslims, or trans people, or ordinary Republican or Democratic voters, or independent voters, or non-voters. Our enemies are those who make billions or even millions of dollars a year, own the politicians, own the land and the resources, and who call the shots in the system. Our enemies are also those who justify and protect the interests of the rich. And because we outnumber them a million times over, they need to invent a million ways to divide us. They use nationalism and xenophobia. They tell us that workers in other countries, whether China or Russia or immigrants from Mexico, they tell us they are our enemy. This is one of Trump and the Republican Party's favorites. They use identity politics, which is favored by the Democratic Party. Identity politics is a systematic weapon used by the ruling class to stoke division between white workers and non-white workers, between workers based on gender, sexual orientation, and nationality, between workers with college education and millions of other workers whom Hillary Clinton insultingly called the basket of deplorables and Biden more recently called garbage. We need to be clear about the difference between identity politics and the fight against oppression. Identity politics is corrosive to working class solidarity. But it is the responsibility of all of us in the working class to fight together against all oppression. against racism, sexism, transphobia, Islamophobia, xenophobia, and every other kind of prejudice. Because if we don't, we are just playing into the boss's ploy to divide us and use that division to keep us all at low wages with poor standards of living and afraid to fight while they rake it in. Some of the most important victories we won through my Socialist City Council office were on issues of oppression, and those victories helped to build for other victories. The Amazon tax itself would not have been won had we not won the support of the rank and file of the Black Lives Matter movement during the George Floyd rebellion in 2020 to defeat Jeff Bezos to win hundreds of millions every year in big business taxes to fund affordable social housing. Our Amazon tax raised $450 million last year alone. The favored tools of the Republicans at present are anti-immigrant and anti-LGBTQ, particularly anti-trans scapegoating. And of course, they try to blame the poor for the poverty. You know, Elon Musk famously or infamously just said, the poor people are parasites. Both wings of the ruling class. He is the parasite, exactly. He and Bezos and Zuckerberg and all the rest of them.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a speech by Shama Sawant given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington on February 22, 2025. The theme was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. Shama Sawant is an Indian American politician and economist who served on the Seattle City Council from 2014 to 2024.
Both wings of the ruling class try to divide us on party lines also to make Democratic voters hate Republican voters and vice versa. The Democratic Party, who use identity politics for their own end, don't actually care about oppressed people. Actually, they stab them in the back the moment they can't leverage them for their own gains. When the Black Lives Matter movement was on the streets in the millions, the Democrats assured us all they were in favor of funding community programs and agreed the police budgets were bloated. They said Black Lives Matter, sometimes with tears in their eyes at press conferences. Then they broke virtually every promise they made with the help of black misleaders who just wanted money for their NGOs and a career ladder to climb. Sellouts come in every color. The Democrats claim to be all about immigrant rights. They attacked Trump for being anti-immigrant. And then Harris ran on the message that she'd be the best builder of the border wall. Many working people are concerned about immigration. This is unfortunately an issue on which Trump currently has support. There is genuine confusion. At the root of the support for deportations is the fact that millions of people have watched the American dream get kicked into the gutter. Millions are stuck in soulless, dead-end jobs that don't pay enough to make rent. They're saddled with student debt, medical debt, credit card debt. They face collapsing school districts for their children, gutting of social services. They're called deplorable, lazy, garbage. They face a society plundered by the billionaires, and they are justifiably angry. Trump and the right wing channel this anger by the scapegoating of immigrants. And we cannot fall for it. The boss's super exploitation and marginalization of immigrants is used to undermine the wages and conditions of all workers, both native-born and immigrant. Low wages for immigrants are used to drive down everyone else's wages. Immigrants worried about being deported are put in a position where it's more difficult for them to make demands for workplace safety, and they get more desperate and accept worse conditions. The net effects are all bad for native-born workers and the working class as a whole, because when the bosses can force immigrant workers to accept worse conditions, that means worse conditions for American-born workers also. Latin American immigrants don't leave their communities and often their families behind to risk everything, sometimes losing their very lives trying to get over the border for no reason. It is because of the devastating effects of US imperialism in their own countries, as well as the climate crisis. More and more deportations and firepower at the border will not end immigrant influx into the United States, and it's not going to solve the problems of American-born workers. The purpose of the anti-immigrant rhetoric is for you to turn your anger away from the billionaires and their sociopathic system of capitalism. If Trump carried out the kind of mass deportations he has talked about, it would have a hugely damaging impact on the economy and millions of native-born workers, as well as immigrants that are deported. It would almost shut down food productions and lead to a massive escalation of prices. Native-born and immigrant workers must stand together against the waves of deportation being carried out by both parties of the billionaires and fight for better wages and conditions for all of us. And incidentally, if Democrats wanted to fight Trump or defend immigrants, they would have immediately removed the totally corrupt and politically bankrupt New York City Mayor Eric Adams, who, in exchange for a corrupt pardon, is helping Trump and ICE carry out deportations. We can't stand for any of this. We have to maintain our focus on the rich. So I ask you, who is our enemy?
The rich.
Who is our enemy? That's right, it's the rich, the billionaires, and don't let them tell you any differently. We need to build unity on a broad basis with all those who want to fight with us against the rich. That part is important. We need unity with those who want to fight against the rich. Unity with those who want to fight is the basis on which we need to build. That is what we have done here in Seattle. That is how we won the highest major city minimum wage in the country and how we've defeated Amazon again and again. There are millions who do want to fight back, and that's whom we are trying to reach, not those who admire the billionaires. What are we fighting for? I hope everyone has had a chance to read Worker Strike Back's program and the Fight the Rich campaign proposal we've circulated here today. These are the main demands we are proposing at our Worker Strike Back convention tomorrow, which we'll be discussing, amending, and voting on. Fight the rich and the billionaire class and their system. Workers need a real raise. $25 an hour minimum wage. Good union jobs for all. Stop the climate catastrophe. Take big energy corporations into workers' ownership. Fight racism, sexism, and all oppression. Stop mass deportations. Medicare for all and quality affordable housing. Tax the rich. End the genocidal war on Gaza, no military aid, no occupation. Bring down Trump, the billionaires, and their two parties. No more sellouts, we need a new party. We need to build our campaigns around things we agree on and that we can use to mobilize many thousands of people to fight for because they could make a real difference in their lives. Both Medicare for All and $25 an hour minimum wage and many of these other demands can inspire people to fight. And we must also keep our focus on ending the genocidal war on Gaza and the brutal occupation. It seems unlikely the current ceasefire will make it to the second phase, and already Israel has breached it multiple times. This is one of the worst genocides of our generation, and we must find every path to stop it. We need to build an international anti-war movement alongside an international workers' movement. We must refuse to support the bosses' wars. And I mean both the war on Gaza and the bloody anti-imperialist war in Ukraine.
No war, but class war.
Exactly. These conflicts are a product of the global capitalist crisis. We are entering into a new era of war, which comes out of the winding down of the era of neoliberal globalization, which was rooted in a world in which US imperialism was the undisputed power. That world is gone. replaced by the US-China global conflict, and with it, economic nationalism and proxy wars. The billionaires in different countries are increasingly locked in violent competition between each other, violence that we face. Imperialist war, including the horrific meat grinder taking place in Ukraine right now, is not in the interests of the working class, and we must reject it. The rich want us to offer up our corpses for the purpose of their fight over profits and resources. Neither Western imperialism nor Russian imperialism cares one bit for Ukrainian workers or Russian workers. Neither does Zelensky. And not one more worker should be dying for Putin or Zelensky. As our friend said just now, the only war for us is class war. And we must support Ukrainian and Russian workers in their fight against their own capitalist classes in bringing down both Putin and Zelensky. That is a fight we should fully take on board. We should have no illusions in Trump's ideas of plundering the natural resources in Ukraine. Trump is no friend of working people in either Russia or Ukraine, and he is no anti-war president. The driving force in Trump's policy on the Ukraine-Russia war is the decisive anti-war message working people sent to the incumbent warmongering party of the ruling class, the Democratic Party, last year. And Trump realizes he needs to reckon with that pressure from the working class, including from his MAGA working class base, who are angry that tens of billions of dollars are being spent on wars and their needs go unfunded. It is all this that has prompted Trump to begin pushing talks for an end to the deeply unpopular war in Ukraine and to declare a temporary ceasefire in Gaza, which he predictably followed up by repeatedly and grotesquely calling for ethnic cleansing in Gaza. When we were campaigning for Jill Stein last year, we said Trump will double down on the war in Gaza. By the way, how shameful is it that Bernie Sanders is railing against the attempts to end the Ukraine war, an end to a war that has ravaged Ukraine and slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian and Russian people? This is what Bernie wants to rail against after he failed to stand up against a genocidal onslaught on Gaza? And now, instead of building a movement against federal employee firings and attacks on working people? So the question for us is, how do we build our movement? How do we fight back? I'll take an example from my first election campaign. We didn't invent the idea of $15 an hour, but it was our movement's victory in Seattle that turned in 2013 and 2014, it turned $15 an hour from a slogan into a national movement and into a series of concrete victories in other cities. Not everyone agreed with 15 when we started, to say the least. When we began organizing around it, it was a radical idea at the time, and many, many dismissed it as utopian. But my fellow socialists and I had the sense that it will inspire workers to fight, and it did, and our movement made history. Campaigning for 15 in my working class election campaign in 2013 was crucial, but it was just the beginning. It took an all-out fight. We immediately used the momentum from our election victory to launch a movement called 15 Now. We held mass organizing meetings, rallies, marches, built neighborhood action groups, and filed a ballot initiative to present a credible threat to big business and the Democrats. If they did not pass a strong 15 in City Hall, we would take it to the ballot box. That is how we won. We won despite all the attempts of the Democrats to block or water down the $15 minimum wage. And we won despite the attempts of some labor leaders behind the scenes trying to convince others in the movement that all we can win is $11 an hour, we should just dump 15. We need to similarly go on the offensive today. And the logistics industry, and specifically Amazon, is crucial. This industry underpins the billionaire's profit-making machine. Unionizing Amazon is therefore a strategically necessary task of the working class. A victory at Amazon would shift the balance of power between bosses and workers. It would set off a wave of strikes and unionization efforts comparable to the massive worker organizing wave of the 1930s. But defeating Amazon will be far from easy. We have seen that even when Amazon workers win union elections, the company will refuse to negotiate. Workers will need to take mass coordinated strike action at multiple key facilities and shut down profits in order to win a union and their demands. We need to unleash the full power of the labor movement and support Amazon workers' efforts with all possible resources. Rank and file union members will need to get organized together across unions along with non-union workers to demand action from existing labor leaders and to build a new fighting union leadership. Some people will ask, shouldn't we be running a lot of candidates for office? We do need to prepare the ground for a mass party of working people. But speaking as a former elected representative of working people myself, my answer to that question will be no, not right now. Not right now is not when we can run lots of candidates for office. Our movement at present is not strong enough to run significant numbers of candidates. Elections are also not the main way that change happens. People with progressive ideas get elected all the time, but without a strong movement behind them, they get absorbed into the system. They capitulate to the enormous pressure from the rich and their politicians. And it might seem ironic to you all that I'm saying this as somebody who has a decade-long track record of having used elected office in the correct way, but I say this because, tragically, that is the only example we can point out in our times of elected office being used in that way. So yes, it can be done, it needs to be done that way, but a sober assessment also is that it hasn't been done otherwise outside Seattle.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a speech by Shama Sawant given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington on February 22, 2025. The theme was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. Shama Sawant is an Indian-American politician and economist who served on the Seattle City Council from 2014 to 2024.
We need to build a stronger movement now through other campaigns and struggles to prepare the ground to be able to run candidates independent of the two parties of the billionaires. Members of our movement who do want to run for office need to be accountable to working people from the outset. They should work with the Fight the Rich campaign on developing a strong working class political platform. They would need to run any such campaign on a clear fighting working class basis and agree to accept only the average worker's wage if elected, as I did during my entire decade in City Hall. And this is another point of confusion. And while it is the bare minimum that elected representatives should do, it is not enough for them to take pro-working class votes on legislation that is in front of them. That is not enough. They need to commit themselves, as I did, to a movement-building approach, to use their office to initiate and support campaigns on bold, far-reaching demands. And even though it will alienate and infuriate both Democratic and Republican politicians. And I'll tell you, a rule of thumb is if you aren't infuriating the Democratic and Republican politicians, you're doing something deeply wrong. They will need to reject a careerist route and instead go to war against both parties and also against the gatekeepers that are around those parties, the NGO leaders, the labor leaders, and so on, to fight to win every possible gain for working people and the oppressed. They need to have the stomach to become enemy number one of the ruling class and arm themselves with mass movements as we did with our office. In addition to going on the offensive, we must also defend against the attacks by the billionaires and their two parties. And that includes the attacks by Trump, which are both a continuation and a serious escalation of the long-term bipartisan project of the U.S. ruling class. It is austerity on steroids, deregulation on steroids, imperialism on steroids, and alongside this, it's the most dramatic concentration of executive power. Trump is pushing things as far as he thinks he can get away with. Trump is not carrying out tariffs for working people. They are a tax on all of us. In fact, we will pay for them through increasingly obscene prices for basic necessities. At root, it's an attempt to confuse us, to pit workers in different countries against each other, and to dishonestly justify more tax cuts for corporations and the rich. Already, 14,000 federal workers have been off. Massive austerity cuts are being carried out. Healthcare services are interrupted. Farmers are in danger of losing their farms. And we have seen Trump and Republicans' latest threats on Medicare and Medicaid. No one should have any expectation at all that Democrats will fight against Trump. Democrats have themselves brought up again and again their willingness to attack Social Security and Medicare, including Obama and his so-called grand bargain. The Democrats paid the way for all this. Our movement was completely correct to reject Harris and the Democrats in the election and to take an independent anti-war pro-worker position behind Jill Stein's campaign and to refuse to bend to the lesser evil pressures. And it's extremely important that Jill and the Green Party ran on a clear anti-war pro-worker program and stood up against all the attacks. The Democrats earned their loss. Had Harris done nothing other than taken an anti-war position on Gaza and condemned the genocide, she would very likely have won. Had she also campaigned on Medicare for All and $15 in addition, Trump wouldn't have had a chance. Trump is being assisted by the complicity of the Democratic Party. Why? Because, it's not that they don't have a spine, quote unquote, as some like to say. They do have a spine when it comes to fighting against working people. When it comes to doubling down on genocide, when it comes to breaking the railroad worker strike, they had a spine when they fought against every single thing our movements fought for in Seattle, from 15 to Amazon tax to renters' rights. They certainly don't oppose austerity. They don't oppose genocide or ethnic cleansing in Gaza. They don't oppose Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. And so they are not about to stick their necks out to defend against attacks on working people and the poor, those same working people and poor people that Democrats spent the last 4 years attacking. The main complaint of the Democrats and the wing of the billionaire class that supported Harris is that they don't like how Trump is doing things, how it is destabilizing the system, their own system, and the credibility in the eyes of working people of their system. And of course, it isn't that Democrats are simply standing aside either. They are frequently joining in. The 12 senators and the dozens of House Democrats who voted for the Riley-Lakin bill, which destroys the right to due process for non-citizens, including legal permanent residents, by allowing ICE to arrest and deport any non-citizen who has been charged, not convicted, charged with a crime which can be as minor as shoplifting. And how about Fetterman's support for Trump's attacks on Palestinians? Bernie approving anti-worker warmonger Marco Rubio's nomination. The list is practically endless. While being clear, though, that the Democrats are not on our side, we also need to be crystal clear about something else. We cannot in any way live in the past. We cannot de-emphasize, understate, or explain away the damage that is currently being done by Trump, Musk, and company. Trump and his cabal of billionaires are doing their level best to do more damage in a few months than the bipartisan attack of Republicans and Democrats was able to do over multiple years. But we should also not overstate, as some do, and say that this is fascism now in the White House. It's important that we not use that word lightly or inaccurately. What fascism is and isn't is a whole discussion unto itself. But the fundamental reality is that while Trump would like to rule as a dictator, there is not the objective basis for it. The overwhelming majority of working people do not support Trump's attacks on democracy. One of Trump's most unpopular political moves was January 6th, which was strongly opposed by the overwhelming majority, including most people who voted Republican. And now his blanket pardon of those guilty of violence on January 6th is itself deeply unpopular, according to the polls. This is also the reason for Trump's doublespeak in saying that free speech is back. He pretends to be pro-democracy because he has to. He is helped by comparison with the Democrats who've been carrying out a crackdown on free speech in recent years, including the brutal repression against campus anti-war protesters. The capitalists, for their part, have absolutely no love of democracy. Yet, they don't want the chaos that goes along with destroying the institution of their system, which have served them incredibly well for almost 250 years. And while they are on board with big parts of Trump's agenda of attacking workers, of austerity, of deregulation, etc., they don't want an unchecked Trump or the kind of utter chaos that fascism brought on the ruling classes and capitalism as a whole in the first half of the 20th century. The capitalists see capitalist democracy, which is of course highly limited and is mainly democracy for the billionaires, but such as it is the best possible shell for their interests. Suffice it to say that if this was fascism, this meeting would not be taking place. Many of us here today would be in prison right now or facing far worse. But we have to be clear about what is happening, how very dangerous it is, and the urgent need to fight back. While we should not for a moment let up on the Democrats, the fact is they are no longer in power. Trump and the Republicans are. And we need to fight back powerfully against them, just as we fought Biden and his party. And it's ironic that, as I said, Elon Musk calls poor people parasitic. He makes $8 million a day from government contracts that his companies have. He's one of the biggest parasites in history. Working people make everything run in this society. We create all the wealth. Nothing works without us. Not the grocery stores, not the electrical grid, not the coffee houses, not the buses, not the Amazon warehouses, not one building in this city, not one board, not one brick was put in place by a billionaire. We need to win over people to our movement who voted for Trump, who voted for Harris, who didn't vote at all, or those who, like us, campaigned and voted for the strongest anti-war pro-worker candidate, Jill Stein. We know from history that we can unite working people through common struggle. For any of you who have been on a picket line, you know what solidarity is. For any of you who've been part of a successful social movement like Tax Amazon, you know what solidarity is. And you know that in successful movements, we can have respectful discussions about our differences and our strategies. We come together around the best strategies and we carry them out together on a principled, united basis. In order for workers to win the 8-hour day or social security or the end of Jim Crow segregation, we had to cut across the divisions and the bosses tried to create. Trump's firing of federal employees is the biggest attack on them since Reagan went after PATCO, the Union of Air Traffic Controllers, and fired 11,000 of them in 1981. That act had devastating effects for the labor movement that have lasted to the present day. So my question is, where is the labor leadership when Trump is firing thousands of union members? In the face of this dangerous escalation of executive power, there should be mass strike action. That would be a way to actually block Trump's assault, to bring the government offices and business of the US state to a grinding halt. To shut down corporate profits, shut down the economy. Instead, we have Auto Workers Union President Sean Fain authoring an op-ed in which he announces he's ready to work with Trump. We have Sean O'Brien, the Teamster leader, kissing up to Trump and MAGA, throwing immigrant workers under the bus, and openly surrendering to anti-union right-to-work laws. This is an absolutely shameful capitulation. It is beyond disgraceful. And let's also note the conspicuous absence of the labor leadership in any effort to build a unionizing drive in Amazon nationally. This is an abdication of responsibility of gigantic proportions because they understand, as we do, that unionizing Amazon is a backbone task to build anything right now. As I said, when we launched Worker Strike Back, we need a reckoning in the labor movement to take down the business unionist leadership and restore the militant, radical, rank and file organizing on which the labor movement was built. And I know many hoped Sean Fain was different. He has proved Sean Fain, auto workers leader. He has proved otherwise. We have to take our movement to the unions whenever possible, wherever possible, as Worker Strike Back has done since our launch. But only 10% of this country is unionized, unfortunately. It's because of the 50 years of capitulation. The working class is not just the unionized workers. It is not just those who work with their hands or who would be considered blue collar. It is all of us who have no choice but to work for a living. All of us, whether we have a union or not, all of us who can't sit back and live off wealth. We need to build a fighting workers movement that includes all of us together, including students, retirees, and the unemployed, all those who want to fight. But who's not wanting to fight? It's clearly the majority of labor leaders, and certainly the Democratic Party leaders are not among those who want to fight. Both of them fear the empowerment of working people and the threat it poses to their system far more than any part of Trump's attacks. It's also the same reason the Democrats extinguished both Bernie campaigns. And so they prefer complicity. And the labor movement has been completely undermined by business unionist leaders who have long been tied at the hip to the Democratic Party and don't want conflict with the bosses. Business unionism is the utterly failed strategy that workers should let labor leaders quietly negotiate contracts with the bosses rather than getting organized to wrench a strong contract from the hands of the bosses. Business unionists put their stress on the bargaining process and they fear antagonizing management by mobilizing workers, much less going on strikes. Business unionist ideas have led to a steadily worsened wages and benefits and working condition situation over the past decades. They have led to dramatic declines in number of workers, as I said, who even have a union. We need to rebuild the labor movement on the basis of class struggle strategies. From the best militant traditions of labor's past, the traditions that were central to the three strikes that led the way in 1934, all strikes, by the way, led by socialists in Minneapolis, in Toledo, and San Francisco. You can watch a recent episode of Worker Strike Back's broadcast on the Minneapolis General Strike. Those same traditions were used to unionize the auto industry in the late 1930s. Militant union organizers, many of whom were socialists or communists, led a massive organizing drive built around a clear understanding of what they were up against and saw their struggle as a class war. They strategically targeted a series of key auto plants that produced components without which the rest of the factories in General Motors could not build cars. They shut down the supply chain and with it, most of GM. They shut down the profits. They threatened the stability of the boss's system, which is what forced them to accept the union and the workers' demands. The success of the auto industry fight, which dealt this massive blow, built the basis for the fastest wave of unionization in US history. We need to learn lessons from those workers' movements today. And we need to build Worker Strike Back into a mass force nationally, as well as other class struggle organizations. We must recognize that there will be no future for humanity on the basis of gradual change or small reforms, which will then be walked back at a later date. Climate crisis is an existential threat. We need to end all fossil fuel use as rapidly as possible. This has been known to science for decades, and yet here we are. To stop climate catastrophe and to stop future more dangerous growth of the right wing, we need to stop capitalism. But we can't do that with these corporations in the hands of the billionaires because we can't control what we don't own. We need to take the big energy corporations, the big banks, all the major corporations into democratic public ownership and run them ourselves. We need to take the reins of society away from the capitalists. All of our fights right now, the small ones and the big ones, have to be towards that end.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was a speech by Shama Sawant given at the Workers' Strike Back Organizing Conference in Seattle, Washington on February 22, 2025. The theme was Fight the Rich and Their Two Parties. Shama Sawant is an Indian-American politician and economist who served on the Seattle City Council from 2014 to 2024. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial. And now we'll round out the hour with a clip from Caitlin Johnstone, read by Tim Foley.
On AI and consciousness. Computer scientist and futurist Jared Lanier made some comments on Vox's The Gray Area podcast the other day that I'd like to make a quick observation about. In the podcast, titled Will AI Become God? That's the Wrong Question, Lanier talks about how artificial intelligence has become a kind of quasi-religion in Silicon Valley, complete with its own deity-like entity and a kind of Armageddon cult-like vision for our future. Asked by host Sean Illing about people's anxiety regarding AI and the possibility of human extinction, Lanier said many in Silicon Valley have come to view humanity as a mere birthing vessel for these new technologies, which will become our vastly superior replacement. What drives me crazy about this is that this is my world, Lanier said. I talk to the people who believe that stuff all the time, and increasingly a lot of them believe that it would be good to wipe out people and that the AI future would be a better one, and that we should wear a disposable temporary container for the birth of AI. I hear that opinion quite a lot. Illing asked, wait, that's a real opinion held by real people? Lanier replied, many, many people. This is obviously disturbing, but it's also just plain bizarre because it shows how little attention these people are paying to the phenomenon of consciousness. AI isn't conscious. Saying AI should replace humanity is the same as saying fire should replace humanity, or white noise static from old televisions should replace humanity. It's not conscious. There's nobody inside it. It's just the dark, empty buzzing of machinery, unwitnessed and unexperienced by any perceiving being. It says so much about the worldview of these weird Silicon Valley cultists that this isn't obvious to them. They think AI would be a superior replacement for humanity because they've paid no attention to consciousness. They've paid no attention to consciousness because they've lived completely unexamined lives. They've never reflected on what it actually means to be a living being, having sentient experiences in this world. Consciousness means subjective experience. It's the hearer of what's heard, the seer of what's seen, the perceiver of thoughts. We can know consciousness exists by our own experience of it, and we can infer that other people and animals must also have it because they have so many similarities to us. There is absolutely no reason to assume that inanimate, inorganic matter is capable of consciousness besides blind faith, religious belief. You see this in the way many of these cultists say people will be able to one day achieve immortality by uploading their minds onto computers. Julian Assange has talked about this Silicon Valley religious belief in the past, saying the following at a 2017 video conference. I know from our sources deep inside those Silicon Valley institutions, they genuinely believe that they are going to produce artificial intelligences that are so powerful relatively soon that people will have their brains digitized, uploaded on these artificial intelligences, and live forever in a simulation, therefore will have eternal life. It's a religion for atheists. They'll have eternal life, and given that you're in a simulation, why not program the simulation to have endless drugs and sex orgy parties all around you? It's like the 72 virgins, but it's like the Silicon Valley equivalent, end quote. Computers aren't conscious. Sure, you might one day be able to replicate the contents of a human mind onto some sort of software, but it won't be you, because it won't be conscious. There'd be nobody experiencing it. It would just be ones and zeros, unilluminated by any perceiving awareness. Consciousness is the only reason life has value. It's the only reason anything matters. Otherwise, life would just be physical materials getting whipped about by natural forces without anyone feeling, sensing, or experiencing any part of it. Suffering wouldn't matter because it's not being felt or experienced. Joy wouldn't matter because it's not being felt or experienced. There'd be no good reason not to torture someone because there wouldn't be any conscious experience of pain. There'd be no good reason to love anyone because there wouldn't be any conscious experience of love. Consciousness is the only reason life is worth living. There is no basis on which to believe AI will ever be conscious. Consciousness isn't some minor detail that science will easily work out once it gets around to it. It's an all-encompassing phenomenon, which has always been a complete mystery to all scientific fields. Science has no idea what consciousness is or why it happens, much less how to replicate it. It's the single most important and fundamental aspect of every second of our waking experience of life, yet it remains a complete unknown to all of science. And this somehow gets left out of so much of the conversation about the future of artificial quote-unquote intelligence. I guess it's possible to become so mind-identified that you really believe you are your thoughts, and that a machine which can generate digital thoughts, as it were, much more efficiently, would therefore be a superior sort of being. You have to have spent no time looking inward and examining what it is that's able to perceive thoughts in the first place. You have to have spent no time in meditation decoupling your sense of identity from the chatter in your head. You must be completely asleep at the wheel of your own life. These are people who have spent their entire lives listening to their thoughts without ever once taking a moment to wonder who the listener is. And these are the people who increasingly rule our world. These are the people inserting themselves into our political systems. These are the people deciding what we may and may not say to each other online. These are the people setting the trajectory for the future of our species. These weird little cultists who are so pervasively unaware of their own inner processes that consciousness does not ever even feature in their understanding of what life is and where it is headed. Just something we should all be aware of.